If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
You know, maybe that was the wrong property to choose as your first property, but you know, at the time we didn't know,
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Brian is the co-founder of the multifamily investing firm Four Oaks Capital. He is also the host of the exciting new Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast. He's an active duty Marine Lieutenant Colonel currently stationed at the Pentagon. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me, Sam.
Oh, man, this is great. The honor is mine. I'm excited to dive in. You guys have done awesome things, and I'm sure we'll get a chance to kind of hear about those. The same questions I ask everyone who comes on. Where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
You know, where did I start? You know, like most people, very cliche, I read Rich Dad Poor Dad. You know, I was mid-20s, and I thought, you know, he talks a lot about commercial real estate. I'm like, oh my gosh, that sounds complicated, difficult. I don't even know where to start. So I started with single family homes. I bought a single family home in my hometown in 2007. You know, bought a house that we moved into in 2008 that we turned into a rental property in 2009. You know, and the plan was every time I move with the military, you know, I'll buy another single family house. Didn't quite work as I had planned out, but I had always in the back of my mind said, real estate is where I want to be. Real estate's what I want to do as soon as my military career ends. And at the time, I didn't know when that end was going to be. You know, right now I'm pretty sure it's going to be in about 176 days. But so that said, you know, a couple of years ago, I realized I needed to put a lot more fuel on the fire, on the real estate fire, so to speak. I also made the realization that single family homes weren't scaling nearly as fast as I wanted them to. So spent a lot of time and money in educating myself on the multifamily, you know, podcasts and books and everything else. Realized that, you know, podcasts and books are great, but I wanted a little extra help. So I paid for coaching, you know, and, you know, long story short, you know, found a couple of partners, you know, some of them were in the same coaching program as I was, some of them weren't. And, you know, together we have since closed on 485 units. That's 7 total deals. And most of them are in South Carolina with one in Augusta, Georgia. Yeah. Long story short, you know, that's where we, you know, how I started, where we're at now. We also have a podcast, which is part of our outreach program. You know, I think you probably understand how that fits into a good business plan, but yeah, Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast is part of that.
Right, right. That's super cool. So, you know, we kind of went high level there on, you got, you know, you hired a mentor, somebody to kind of show you the ropes. You found some partners. Can you give us kind of some of the details on that, you know, as you went through that process of, did you just pick one mentor? Did you vet several along the way? Was there, what was that kind of thought process as you finally selected the person to work with?
You know, at the time, I didn't know how many different mentorship programs were out there. I knew of two, you know, and it was the two main podcasts that I listened to. It was Michael Blanc and Rod Cleef. And, you know, Michael Blanc for the longest time was living in Northern Virginia. And so when I moved out here and started working at the Pentagon, which is Northern Virginia, it just kind of made sense. I'm like, okay. And I did a lot of vetting. You know, I went to, you know, one of his big conferences, and I talked to everybody that, you know, had phone calls with people, and talked to everybody that had been associated with his program first. So that's the vetting that I did. I did not compare his to another program, but I think that some of the key things is, you know, he had a lot of people who were successful that had gone through his program, number one. And number two, there were a lot of potential partners in his program, you know, because it's definitely a team sport. I knew I needed to eventually, and, you know, when I first started, I was solo. I had nobody else, you know, it was just, I was scared about how I was even going to find partners, to be honest with you. But, you know, I realized that, okay, if I jump into this, you know, his network now becomes my network. And there's a bunch of people who are hustling, who are, you know, following his program, and it's going to give me a better opportunity to find partners. And that's exactly what ended up happening.
Right, right. And so what were some of the skill sets that were different maybe than yours that you began to look for initially in a partnership?
You know, so I branded myself. I thought, you know, I'd be better at finding and analyzing deals, you know. So I was looking for people who could bring capital to the table. You know, I think those are the two big things that you need is, you know, somebody to find and analyze and somebody to bring the capital to the table. So it actually ended up not being, that's not how it ended up working. I ended up finding somebody who we partnered with. Eric Shirley was the first person that I met from current Four Oaks Capital. But he actually has the same skill set as I do, you know? So when I first met him, I didn't really think of him as a viable partner because I was looking for that capital raiser.
Right.
But he's now our acquisitions manager, but we ended up deciding to partner on a deal. And, you know, we sat down and said, who else do we need on our team? And went out and found that other guy who could help us raise capital. So yeah, I think you definitely need to make sure that, you know, between a partnership, you can cover down on all aspects of the business. You know, we got two guys that are, you know, very analytical. He's doing the acquisitions job because, you know, his full-time, you know, he still has a full-time job. We're both trying to exit our full-time jobs, you know, this year, probably, definitely for me, maybe for him. But, you know, his is a little more conducive to, you know, acquiring new assets than mine is.
Right, right. That's interesting. You know, you often hear, you know, hire or find partnerships that are opposite your strengths. So how did you guys, I guess, define that? Once you both said, hey, look, we both have the same strengths. Now how are we going to split duties?
You know, at first we were both, you know, busy acquiring. We were both in the acquisitions training, you know, and of course, when you own zero properties, that's really all there is to do, you know? So,
right. Sure.
Yeah. It's like, okay, you know, we're both looking for deals. And we kind of agreed that, you know, we had, you know, a circle on the map where if it's anything inside this circle, the metros that we're both interested in, we will partner on this stuff. You know, and I was looking at a couple other areas that weren't inside that circle, and so was he. But, you know, end of the day, you know, when we finally got a deal under contract, we were both like, all right, let's go. But, you know, once we started doing, you know, once we closed on a couple of properties and started doing the asset management, what really was the deciding factor for us was time. I work at the Pentagon, you know, and pre-COVID, you know, that meant, you know, walking into the building, putting my phone in a box for 8 hours a day, which incidentally are the same 8 hours a day that all the professionals we need to talk with in running a property are, you know, available, you know? So for us, it was really more of a time issue, you know, in order to, I mean, I could set up an appointment with a property manager, you know, grab my phone, walk out to the Pentagon courtyard and have a phone call or, you know, get on a Zoom call from the parking lot or gym or whatever. But I was not flexible in responding to their calls to me, which we realized needed to happen. So, you know, a lot of the ways we assigned our duties and responsibilities were, I mean, both based off of, you know, strengths, but also based off of time, you know. And out of the four of us, we have, you know, two people who are, you know, very creative. So out of the four of us, we have a lot of overlap, and we also have 360 coverage. So Eric ended up being the acquisition manager because he's not stuck in a box, you know, all day, every day of the week. So, I mean, now with COVID coming out, you know, I telework more than I actually go into the Pentagon. So, you know, had we been developing our business plan, you know, up front right now, that may have been a little different.
Right, right. So the two of you, you know, you guys joined up and then you brought on a third partner and now there's four of you total.
Yep.
Right. And hence the name Four Oaks.
Yeah, Four Oaks. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So. I love that. Talk to us a little bit about how you guys strategized around your capital needs.
So about the capital needs, I mean, we all up front, we all looked at our network. You know, we all basically said, this is how much from my network I think I can raise. And, you know, so when I decided to partner with Eric had already partnered with a guy named Brian, you know, who is, you know, one of the Four Oaks right now. But, you know, between the four of us, we sat down and we said, okay, how much do you think you can raise from your network? And we all put numbers on the board. And that kind of helped us guide us in what size property that we were looking for, you know. So we felt that we could bring in, you know, three of us together somewhere around $1 million. And we ended up finding a property where we needed about $1.5 million to, you know, what I think our final capital raise ended up being bigger. That's a different story. But, you know, going in, we thought we were going to need about $1.5 million. So, you know, our strategy session was, okay, three of us together think we can do $1 million. We need to get to $1.5 million. How do we do this? You know, and Eric's like, hey, I met a guy, you know, a couple of weeks ago. I think he'd be a good fit. And, you know, that's how, you know, Todd Butler came into the group. And at first it was four guys hustling, trying to get one deal across the finish line. But, after, several weeks in a row of, two to three Zoom calls a week, talking about this deal and how to get it across the finish line and everything else, we realized we all had the same goals. We all worked together well. We liked each other, and that's all big. And that's when we decided to make it exclusive. But, as far as strategizing on capital, every deal is a little different. I think we are always in the business of raising capital, which I think is very important for somebody in this is, whether you have an active deal or not, you need to always be raising money. You need to always be talking to people about, investing in real estate. And, right now our strategy is just grow our network, keep on growing the network, keep on bringing people in who are potential investors, and try our best to, give them enough content to get them comfortable with us, to get them, and it's as impersonal as it is, the podcast is great for that because, people can learn more about us, without us, having to spend individual time with everybody. Individual time is much, much better. The personal touch goes a long way, but, our capital raising platform right now, we've got a lot of different arms that we're a lot of different ways we're approaching it. But end of the day, it's just bring more and more good people into the network.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. So you guys have been at this full time. Well, I'm not going to say full time, I guess part time. What, 3 years now? Or going on, this would be your third year?
Going on 3 years, right.
Right. Going on 3 years. If you could rewind the last 2 years, going on three, what are some things that you would do differently?
Wow. A lot of things, actually. I mean, so the first property, I think we made, everybody makes mistakes on their first property.
Or the 100th property.
Everybody makes mistakes on every property, sure. To be honest with you, So on the first property, I think the biggest thing that we had to overcome was, we got pinched on loan proceeds. I think we went in with our underwriting with a very rosy picture of, what our loan would look like. We were hearing everybody say, yeah, you can get, 75 to 80% loan to value. And, with Fannie Mae loans, you can get up to, $1,000 a door in capital expenses included in the loan, that's kind of held in an escrow account or that's dispersed later. So we went in with this idea of we're going to get 75% LTV plus some renovation dollars, get the place under contract and start pushing forward. And I think our final loan amount, just because we were, debt service compressed, our final loan was about 68% loan to value with no renovation dollars thrown in, Ooh. I mean, fortunately, between the time that when we first started underwriting the project, rates came down. So it didn't have that drastic of an effect, but we did have to move the needle. I mean, We went in advertising a 75-25, investor to GP split. And in order to make that deal, the numbers pencil on that deal for the investors, we had to move the needle to 90-10. So that ended up being a six pref with a 90-10 split afterwards. So very skinny for us, but we realized this was going to be the first of many deals and there was more value to making it work without taking a paycheck than there was not making it work, So that was the first thing. And just not really understanding the lending market, not really understanding how everything, the lenders determine your total loan amount, really bit us. But, fortunately, the investors are making money on the deal. And, we've had a little bit of COVID hit that deal a little harder than some of our others. We had a little struggle with vacancy, but, we're back up to just under 100% occupancy on that property right now. So long story short on that property, we're going to give the investors the returns that we forecasted. We're not going to make a lot of money, but it was the foot in the door. It was the one that got us on the map.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. And congrats to you guys for still hitting your benchmarks. What were some of the things that the lenders, why were you not able to secure the lending maybe that other people said you should be able to secure?
Yeah, it was debt service is all it is. And it was me not asking the right questions or not knowing the right questions to ask, So, I called, we were working with a broker and she was fabulous, but we were working with a broker and I just didn't ask the right questions, And I went in with a lot of assumptions. So I'm like, okay, so on a Fannie Mae loan, you know, what's the max proceeds we can get? And she's like, yeah, in certain cases you can get up to 80%, but don't bank on 80%. You know, and she was giving me very general guidelines to underwrite to. And really what happened is I didn't pay a lot of attention to that debt service coverage ratio. You know, she was upfront. She told me, and oh, by the way, you need to have this 1.25 debt service coverage, you know? And so when we finally applied for the loan, I mean, we'd already had the property under contract for almost a month when we applied for the loan. You know, she came back and she's like, hey, you know, this is your proceeds. This is what we can get you with the Fannie. This is what we can get you with the Freddie, you know? And I had one of those very sick sinking feelings when I saw the numbers. I'm just like, oh my gosh. Yeah, and we did the best we could to work with her to get those, you know, numbers back up. You know, we tried to get creative on some things. We fought the comps and won, you know. So this property is in downtown Spartanburg, and the lender was using comps from, you know, all over the county.
Oh, geez.
And yeah, so we were able to come in and take, you know, look at the comps that they used to determine, you know, what the rents would be. And we were able to say, no, use these comps. And, you know, I put it on a spreadsheet, you know, or not on a spreadsheet, put it on a PowerPoint, you know, on a map, you know, this is downtown, you know, and I explained, hey, downtown's better. The prices in downtown are a lot higher for, you know, per square foot. And I made a case saying you're using the wrong comps. And we ended up getting a couple $100,000 in proceeds just off of that, you know. So part of it, you know, we had to fight for every dollar on that particular property. But yeah, end of the day, you know, that debt service ratio, the banks all have a certain way to compute the debt service ratio, and, you know, they don't budge from how they compute debt service, you know, so they're going to use, you know, their database to come up with expenses instead of, you know, what's on your pro forma sheet for expenses. And, you know, when the debt service numbers are tight, that makes a big difference, you know, and quite frankly, that's the only property that we were pinched on debt service. Everything else we've had is, you know, met the 1.25, you know, with flying colors. But anyway, that was, you know, maybe that was the wrong property to choose as your first property. But you know, at the time we didn't know what we didn't know.
Right, right. Yeah. And there's no again, you don't know what you don't know. That's interesting. I mean, the fact that they're going to use their own expense formulas. I mean, do they share those expense, you know, calculations with you so that you can plug those into your underwriting, or is that something that you just got to kind of play the game blind and hope you're right?
I mean, there's a little bit of negotiation. I mean, they did share, you know, I definitely got their numbers, but you know, the particular lender that we were using, and I've talked to several lenders since, but they all do something similar. I mean, a lot of owners will run the expenses super thin the year before they sell it, you know, so.
Sure.
So they don't use the T12 for expenses a lot of times. Okay, typically they're going to use a combination. I mean, they'll look at the T12 expenses, but they're also going to look at the average market expenses, and they've got access to a lot of data to be able to pull these in. You know, so you know if they look at the expenses that the property is looking at, and they do look at the T12. You know, I'm not saying they don't, but they look at the T12. But if there's a discrepancy between what's on the T12 and what their market data says, they're going to go with their market data, or they're going to go with whichever one's more conservative from their standpoint. And there were a couple of line items that you know, and like I said, we had to fight for every dollar. There were a couple of line items where they said, okay, your T12 says this, we're using this number. You know, your T12 says this, but we're using this number, you know. And most of it was just backed around the market research. And banks are, you know, very conservative. They want to make sure that they're getting, you know, their returns. And so that's basically how they do it. And you've got to kind of convince them, you know, using real actual numbers, that's actually the case.
Right. And I think you made an interesting point when you said that the properties that you guys are taking down now, it sounds like you're underwriting for a much stronger DSCR maybe than what you were on the first deal.
Yeah. And in the first deal, we used agency, and the agency has a little more strict criteria. We've also had a couple of bridge loans as well. And they're a little more forgiving on the numbers. They'll have a slightly lower DSCR. And we've actually assumed a Freddie Mac loan and a Fannie Mae loan. So the agency loans that we've had since have both been assumptions, you know. So they've already done all the underwriting, they've already done everything. They still do a little bit more, but it's not as rigorous of a game for them, because they've already underwritten the loan and they've already, you know, given out the money. It's just changing the name on the loan from that point. So I mean, yeah, if we were to apply for a new Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan tomorrow, frankly, it's a different environment, but we would still have to go through the same process.
Right. Assumption. That's an interesting, you know, you hear a lot about that. You don't hear people who get those across the finish line every day. So can you tell us a little bit about assumptions? Like, what was that process like? You know, why is it beneficial? You know, things like that.
So in one case, we were talking with a seller, and he had some very strict timelines that he wanted to meet. He wanted to do a 1031 exchange with that property, you know, and there's a clock that starts when you sell the property, and you have 180 days to get into a new property. And so what we arranged with that seller was we were going to do a master lease with him, and we were going to basically control the property and pay him, you know, a certain amount every month. And when he found the property he wanted to 1031, he wanted to do the exchange into, we would execute a purchase contract, right? So that's what we had originally negotiated. And, you know, with that said, he was running up to the end of his timeline on when I think he had a bridge loan on it. So he refinanced the loan knowing that we would purchase it later. And that was part of the calculus going in, is that we would have to assume that loan. So it made sense for us. It made sense for him, you know. So that one was actually easy. The process took a long time because, you know, COVID shut everything down right in the middle of the process. So it took 6 months to assume that one. The second one we assumed, the seller had a very large prepayment penalty, you know, and if you get, you know, the wrong type of loan that doesn't match your business plan, he had a seven-figure prepayment penalty. So, I mean, it's just one of those where it's hard to make that work as a seller if you're going to pay $1 million to the bank for selling early. So we were able to negotiate the purchase price down significantly because of the loan that he was carrying. You know, he had gotten a loan in 2018 at a 5.1% interest rate. You know, current rates are 3.5%. So, you know, we took it on the chin with an interest rate, a higher interest rate, but we ended up getting about $1 million off of, you know, what the market value is. So we looked at that as a good trade, you know, a very low basis, but we pay a little bit more for our debt. But yeah, so in that case, the assumption, you know, made sense for the seller because he didn't have to pay a large fee. And, you know, we were able to negotiate a killer price on it. So ended up being a win-win for both of us. And incidentally, that assumption, we were, you know, start to finish in less than 2 months.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's pretty cool. That's great. That's great timing. Brian, let's jump into the final four if we can. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Start. That's it. Just do it. I mean, don't wait. Just take what you know and start putting it into action. Doesn't matter where you're at.
That's great. That's great. What is one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
I like my podcast. You know, I think the podcast, you're talking with people, you know, who are light years ahead of you in a lot of cases. And, you know, you get so many good nuggets from just talking to other people.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. When it comes to giving back, what's one way you are making the world a better place?
You know, I give 10% of my income to my church, you know, and they have a substantial charitable arm and do a lot of good with it. So yeah, that's one thing. I guess that's all you asked for, right? One thing.
That's it. That's it, man. No, I love it. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do we do that?
Email address, brianbriscoe@fouroakscapital.com. The website is fouroakscapital.com. Or our podcast, you know, you can hear me talk 3 times a week. It's Diary of an Apartment Investor.
Brian, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate your time too.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.